90.1 FM. As a reminder, if you want to hear the rest of today's conversation, which includes spoilers for X, a review of that second beer we talked about, and Hot and Bothered, head over to your favorite podcast app and subscribe to Fresh Hop Cinema. The rest of this episode will be available tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. And to those of you already listening on your preferred podcast app, we'll be right back.
How high's the water, mama? 2 feet high and rising. How high's the water, papa? She said it's 2 feet high and rising. But we can make it to the road in a homemade boat, 'cause that's the only thing we got left that'll float. It's already over all the wheat and oats. 2 feet high and rising. How high's the water, mama? 3 feet high and rising. How high's the water, papa? She said it's 3 feet high and rising. Well, the hives are gone, I lost my bees. Chickens are sleeping in the willow trees. Cows in water up past her knees. 3 feet high and rising. How high's the water, mama? 4 feet high and rising. How high's the water, papa? She said it's 4 feet high and rising. Hey, come look through the window pane. The bus is coming, gonna take us to the train. Looks like we'll be blessed with a little more rain. 4 feet high and rising. How high's the water, mama? 5 feet high and rising. How high's the water, papa? She said it's 5 feet high and rising. Well, the rails are washed out north of town. We gotta head for higher ground. We can't come back till the water goes down. 5 feet high and rising. Well, it's 5 feet high and rising.
You're listening to 90.1 FM, KZFR, community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. My name is Ron Topi, and this is the North State Water Report. The North State Water Report is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, your local state partner to the California Arts Council since 2001. Friends of the Arts creates economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and by publishing a bi-monthly arts and culture newsletter. Stay in the know. Or have your event listed, visit friendsof.art. And by Drunken Dumpling in Chico, serving locally sourced, fresh, homemade, Asian fusion comfort food at 1414 Park Ave, Suite 120, just behind Nobby's. Open 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. Tuesday through Thursday, and from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Friday and Saturday. Details on Facebook, Instagram, and at DrunkenDumplingChico.com. Drunken Dumpling, where they love food, flavor, and our community. And by D.A. Lampe Construction, a proud supporter of KZFR and Community Radio in Northern California. For more information, visit DALampeConstruction.com. And we're going to be right back after this song by Dana Lyons called Drop of Water. And tonight I will have Patrick Porgans of Porgans and Associates. And his firm was involved in monitoring the operation of the state water projects, Oroville Dam and Reservoir flood control operation since 1985. So I'm going to play this song while I get Patrick on the line, and we will be right back.
Water on the wall, and the drop's about to fall, and it falls into a trickle, and the trickle is flowing down, down, down to the ground, and the moss begins to grow. Watch, 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 watch the water flow, and watch the current become a stream, busting through the seams, cracking through the concrete, bending down the steel, in a raging that is real, a tearing torrent you can feel. Feel the thunder growing, thunder underground, and in my heart, the chains falling apart, the wildness in my soul. And for once in life, I know I'm not alone. For the mountains make our bones, with the oceans in our blood, our feet planted, planted firmly in the mud. We are alive, the burning embers in our eyes, a tingling touch upon our skin. And in the heat of passion, we begin to understand that we are of this land, that we are part of Earth. And when it's threatened, we will fight for all we're worth. We watch the dam come crashing down, water rushing to the sea. And now the river, now the river, now the river, now is free. Drops about to fall, and it falls into a trickle, and the trickle's flowing down, down, down to the ground, and the moss begins to grow. Watch, 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 watch the water flow, and watch the current become a stream, busting through the seams, cracking through the concrete, bending down the steel. In a raging that is real, a tearing torrent you can feel. Feel the thunder growing, thunder underground. And in my heart, the chains falling apart, water rushing to the sea. And now the river, now the river, now the river, now is free.
Welcome back, listeners, and tonight I have on the line with me Patrick Porgans of Porgans Associates. His firm has been actively involved in monitoring the operation of the state water projects Oroville Dam and Reservoir Flood Control Operation since 1985. Porgans is a forensic research analyst and has been retained by farmers, ranchers, businesses, and law firms on every major flood disaster downstream from Oroville Dam since 1980. That includes the February 1980, 1986, 1987, and the 2017 partial collapse of the Oroville Dam flood control spillway outlet. In 2009, he was retained by the Feather River Recovery Alliance, a grassroots organization comprised of residents and businesses downstream of the Oroville Dam. That's quite a bit, Patrick. How are you doing tonight? Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Thank you. Thank you for having me on. And you know, pardon my voice. I'm getting hit with the allergies like everyone else. I'd just like to make two minor adjustments there. With the 1997 flood, not 1987. And then the other thing is, it was 2019 that we were retained by the Feather River Recovery Alliance.
Yeah, 2019. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, why don't we start by just kind of explaining exactly what that facility is there for? Like, what is the multi-purposes of the dam itself and the reservoir and the whole facility?
Well, that's a good point. It's a multi-purpose facility, and it's designed for, you know, water storage, which they call conservation. It's for hydroelectric power generation, for recreational purposes, and above all, for flood control purposes. The during the winter season, flood control has priority over all the other uses there at the reservoir. And what we've done is we've gone back and we've looked, oh, by the way, the flood control component of the dam was not paid for by the water contractors. The flood control facilities were paid by you and me, the U.S. taxpayers. So, as I mentioned, you know, we've gone back and been involved since 1980, looking at the operation of the reservoir, specifically at times during the winter season. And, you know, what we have found is that, you know, the Department of Water Resources has a propensity to use portions of the flood storage space at Oroville. Is 750,000 acre feet of space that's set aside during the winter season specifically for flood control purposes. The reservoir itself can hold 3.5 million acre feet of water. So when you get a series of warm storms, they used to call them pineapple expresses, or you get a series, what they're now referring to, U.S. Geological Survey is referring to as arc storms, like Noah's Ark storms. So what happens in the 1980, 1986, 1997 flood in particular, we had ground saturation up in the Oroville watershed that's above the dam. And there's a flood control manual that's been developed and in force for the flood control operations at Oroville Dam. Unfortunately, the way it works is that DWR is monitoring itself there. Once the Corps adopts this flood control manual, which, you know, is required by federal law, then the department monitors itself. What we found is that during those flood periods, 1980, 86, 97, and to some extent in 2017, we had ground saturation up there in the watershed. We had the department slightly encroached into the designated flood storage space, that 750,000 acre feet of space. And we had a series of warm storms coming all the way from Hawaii to the coast of California. So the manual requires, the flood control manual requires that the department make certain releases depending upon how much water is coming into the reservoir under those conditions that I just made reference to. Ground wetness index, antecedent precipitation, where they are within that designated flood storage base. So what's happened is the record. Now, when I'm speaking, the audience needs to understand this is not conjecture. It's not subjective information. This information is taken and extrapolated from government documents, okay? More specifically, from DWR's public records. So what the information shows is that when you have that series of conditions and you have this series of storms coming in, DWR tends to hold on to the water there in the reservoir. And the reason why it's holding water, and to some degree it's allowed to store a certain amount of water in that designated flood storage space. However, it's dependent upon how much water is coming in and all of those other conditions I referenced earlier. So what they do, because the State Water Project has contracted for more water than it can provide, it's got a contract for 4.1 million acre feet. Most of the water that DWR provides to its State Water Project contractors comes from Oroville Dam. So because they can't meet those contractual agreements only about 50% of the time, DWR then stores water. It's called an unauthorized storage of water in the flood storage space, and they hold on to it for two reasons. One, because they release the water slowly through the power generators, and they can generate more revenue from releasing the water slowly. The second purpose is it allows them to ensure that they can provide more water for their contractors. Now, the problem is it's fundamental. DWR has a conflict of interest. In one sense, it's a water purveyor, and in another sense, it's designated as a public trustee, and it is responsible for providing flood protections for the entire state of California. So what's happened here, and this is something people don't understand, the water that comes out of Oroville, when they're holding on to that water, and when these series of storms come in, which they have all that information from the National Weather Service, the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, and they have their own flood control center. When they have that information coming in and they hold back, then as storms increase and the inflow into the reservoir continues, they then have a propensity to dump more water than they would have had they released it in accordance with the flood control release requirements in the manual. Understand what I'm saying there?
Yeah, so that's pretty much what happened in 2017. They had too much water held back, and then when it started to fill up so rapidly, they had to let out too much, and then the spillway collapsed, and they had to let it overflow. So it's just a compounding. Is that basically what you're talking about?
Well, the situation in 2017 was a little bit different than what happened in 86 and 97, and that is, yes, in the 2017 event, which we're now the fifth anniversary of the spillway, partial collapse of the spillway, that February marks the fifth year. And then, which also marks the 25th year of since the 1997 flood event. You know, and what happened is that in that case, in the 2017, yes, the ground was saturated up there. I had sent a note to the Army Corps of Engineers, notifying them that DWR was slightly encroached into the designated flood storage, and we did have a series of storms coming in. And I was concerned that they keep an eye on what was going on up there. So what happened, when they were releasing water from Oroville, initially they were holding back. The maximum amount of water that was released from Oroville Dam on February 7th of 2017, was around 50-plus thousand cubic feet a second. The spillway can push out up to 250,000 cubic feet a second. The spillway collapsed under minimum outflow conditions, okay? So what happened next was when that they examined the hole that was in the spillway, they stopped releasing water to check and see, you know, just how extensive the damage was. And as they were doing that, which, you know, if they, you know, got a UAV or, you know, lighter radar, we could have told them in a matter of hours the extent of the damages. But they held back for an extended period of time making decisions because they didn't have a plan to deal with such a catastrophe. So while all that was happening, the water was building up behind that reservoir and ultimately came over the spillway. And one of the reasons why there were two reasons why it became a real problem. One, when that water, the flood water, was coming over the auxiliary flood control outlet, which, you know, it's on that left side of the embankment, it started to erode.
It's essentially an overflow, isn't it?
Excuse me?
It's essentially just an overflow, isn't it?
That's it. That's correct. So because they weren't releasing the water, the power plants, they were concerned the power plants were going to become damaged, and they were concerned, you know, they had a few other issues that they were preoccupied with. So in that instance, they then resorted to releasing higher flows. And those higher flows is what then, you know, caused more extensive damage. So I wanted to differentiate there. You know, had they, you know, the records show that the damages that were, you know, caused there at the 2017 event was partially the result of the major flood water releases they made from Orville in 1997, okay? So there are records which we obtained and others that show that DWR knew that there were problems with the spillway and that it was in need of repair, but DWR didn't make the necessary repairs. And that information was confirmed by two independent forensic experts.
You found that out after the accident, right?
Well, no, the data that showed that there were problems with the structural stability of the spillway was contained in DWR's files. We did get that information subsequent to that time, but they knew that they had a problem. That's very well documented. And the independent forensic reports that were done by experts that DWR hired showed that it was a maintenance issue from the very beginning. The spillway was not built to, you know, the design that it was initially planned for. So those were some of the issues that caused or exacerbated the problems they experienced in 2017. However, getting back to the 1980 in the 1986 and the 1997 flood, what was happening there was by holding too much water back, they released additional flows. And those flows, you know, anything about over 150,000 cubic feet a second causes extreme damages downstream from the dam. So in two of the cases that in the 86 and 1997 flood, DWR was found at fault for both of those damages associated with those floods. And it was loss of lives and over $1 billion worth of damages resulting from the 86-97 flood.
What was it? What was it that happened that proved that it was their fault? What had happened? What did they do to cause it?
Well, two things. They were holding back on the water again and making limited releases while the inflows were increasing significantly. That was one. They neglected their own weather forecast information, and they knew that the conditions that existed at the time were problematic. So the way the manual is set up is that you're allowed to release X amount of water under certain conditions. In the case of the 86 and 97, they were holding back on too much water. And then to make up, you know, for that inflow, because in 1997, the Department of Water Resources projected that there would be over 400,000 cubic feet a second coming into the reservoir, okay? So they went and released 167,000 cubic feet of water from the reservoir subsequent to the early warnings that they had a problem. The flood control manual allows for, you know, it states that a standard project flood at Oroville, I don't want to give these, you know, your listeners too much information, but this is important. A standard project flood is when we have 440,000 cubic feet a second of water coming into Oroville. It has a three-day volume of 1.5 million acre feet. And then under those circumstances, they're allowed to release up to 150,000 cubic feet a second. However, the standard project flood did not occur in 86, nor did it occur in 1997 or in the 2017 spillway incident. So the maximum inflow was about 300,000. And as I mentioned earlier, the outflow was 167,000 cubic feet a second. So what that essentially did, the way the downstream channels are configured, they have a certain design flow capacity. They can only handle so much water that's coming out of Oroville. So when you release 150,000 cubic feet a second, there's about another 40,000 cubic feet a second that comes in below Oroville, you know, from the various tributaries. So when the water's coming down from Oroville, just above the confluence of the Yuba River, the flows there are set, you know, for about 180,000 cubic feet a second. And just below the Yuba, it's at 300,000 when the Yuba empties into the Feather River. So the flood control manuals, the master flood control manual, requires that Oroville and New Bullets Bar Dam, which is on the Yuba River, are supposed to be worked where you stagger releases. If you have a large amount of release coming out of Oroville, then you're supposed to try to limit the amount of water that's coming out of the Yuba River. Although the Yuba River only contains about 37% of the entire Yuba River watershed.
And DWR.
Flood. The U.S. Corps of Engineers told the Yuba County Water Agency not to release, to hold back on the releases. Well, when it hit the fan, you know, when it push came to shove, they were required to release the waters while the waters in the Feather River were higher than 180,000 and above 300,000 below the Yuba, where it empties in. So the total flow that we gathered, this is from DWR's documents and USGS documents, Yuba County Water Agency, was about 357,000 cubic feet a second, okay, below the confluence there at the Yuba.
And DWR operates the dam on the Yuba River as well?
No, that's the Yuba County Water Agency. They're responsible for that.
Oh, okay.
But they take directions from the Corps of Engineers under certain circumstances. Okay?
Okay.
So, but, and, you know, Yuba County asked them, why did you tell us to hold back on the water? Because that created a problem. But at any rate, so then we had all this damage. You know, we had levee breaks and so forth and so on. So then the matter went to court, both on the 86 and the 1997 flood. And in both cases, DWR was guilty. Now, you would think if, you know, DWR was at fault for holding back on water for the conflicting purposes that it serves, you know, as a water purveyor and as a public trustee to provide flood protections, why would they not be held responsible for paying the billions of dollars in damages attributable to their negligence and mismanagement of the reservoir?
That's a good question. I mean, when they are, essentially because they're a state agency, that means taxpayer money pays for the damages, even though there are actual people that work for that state agency that are the responsible ones, the agency is held responsible, so the taxpayers pay.
Yeah, see, that's the problem you have, Peter. They have a win-win situation, you know, if the public loses. So what happens is they either go out and float general obligation bonds to pay for the damages, but ultimately the money, the billions of dollars that are paid out, come from the general fund, which is money that comes from you and me for taxes, you know, whether you're buying food or your labor, you know, whatever tax that the state imposes on you. So what the objective that we're working on here now is to get the Department of Water Resources in a position where they're going to have to be held accountable for any future flood damages that occur there in the Feather River watershed, and that the people downstream should not be paying to, you know, maintain levees or to, you know, for their loss of properties or loss of lives. The public should not be paying for that. That should be coming from DWR, and it should be coming from the State Water Project contractors, who are the major beneficiaries of the water from the Orville Dam, which, by the way, although the water contractors pay for, you know, operation and maintenance, they pay for the capital costs for the project, for the transportation costs, and so forth. There's no cost for the water. The water's free. Okay?
Right. Yeah, we're going to take a quick station identification break here, Patrick, for a second, and read some underwriters. You are listening to 90.1 FM KZFR Community Radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And this is the North State Water Report. The North State Water Report is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Mountain Sports. For over 45 years, providing outdoor clothing and equipment for hiking, backpacking, camping, traveling, and enjoying the great outdoors. Mountain Sports is open Monday through Saturday from 10 a.m. till 5 p.m. and 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Sundays at 176 East 3rd Street in downtown Chico. And we're talking with Patrick Porgans of Porgan & Associates, and we're talking about the work that Patrick has done since the 1980s, in which is monitoring the state water projects, Orville Dam, and reservoir flood control operations. And we were just kind of, I guess we were just kind of finishing up talking about the history of some of these other, some of the past floods, and how, you know, DWR has been found at fault of causing the damages from all these previous floods. And that kind of takes me to a couple questions. I'm looking here at, you sent me this this summary fact sheet from a petition that was served to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission by the Feather River Recovery Alliance. And
that was the template for them to send it. To my knowledge, I'm not aware that it's actually been sent. We were working with the attorney and the Feather River Recovery Alliance, which is a grassroots organization there in Oroville, you know, composed of businessmen and property owners. Mm-hmm. You know, they're putting a lot of their own time and resources into trying to come up with a viable solution to mitigate these problems in the future. So we conducted some research for them and put it in a fact sheet, you know, giving them some basic answers to some questions as to, you know, what's some of the things we just previously discussed. However, they're working with the Department of Water Resources and the California Natural Resources Agency now. They have what they call the Oroville Dam Citizens Advisory Committee, and they meet every so often. They just met the last part of March, and they talk about, you know, certain things that, you know, they may be able to do and they may not be able to do. But from what we've gathered from those meetings, the department is not dealing with the fundamental issues that we've discussed previously.
Yeah.
And based upon the historical record.
Advisory committees always sound good, but they never really get much done, do they?
Well, yeah, and the other problem is they don't really have any enforcement. There's no teeth.
Yeah.
So they're, you know, they're working on, well, you know, DWR's got good faith that, you know, maybe DWR will, you know, be kind or do something. But see, DWR is not going to change the operational criteria there at Oroville unless there's a mechanism to compel them to do so. And that mechanism is in what you just mentioned about the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and someone filing what you call a motion of intervention, because DWR, since 2007, has a pending license renewal for the State Water Project Oroville facilities.
And that's through FERC.
The provisions of the FERC license, they are required to assess what the impacts are as a result of operating the dam. And one of the things they would have to do is explain to the public what the level of risk are, you know, by moving 250 to as much as 600,000 acre feet of water, second feet of water, from the spillway or coming over the top of the dam. What is that going to do to downstream property owners? Now, there was a recent report at the, well, 10 years old, but they're updating the report now. The U.S. Geological Survey, which is a very, you know, unbiased and objective agency, they showed that with the climate change, you know, where we're getting, you know, these, you know, storms that come in, which, as I mentioned earlier, arc storms, or previously Pineapple Expresses. When you have a lot of snow at higher elevations, and then you have a series of warm storms come in, what happens is that you have a massive amount of water that's melting and moving down the river. The USGS report estimates, and this is with the dam intact, this is no dam breach, dam intact, they show that the inundation would cause $725 billion worth of damages. The extent of the damages would from Oroville Dam downstream all the way through the Delta and down into the San Francisco Bay. 1.5 million Californians will have to be evacuated, and 250,000 of them will have to be permanently relocated. Okay? This is the kind. And this storm, it has happened, and they're saying with the climate change, it's inevitable. So what we're doing is we're putting DWR in the position where they're going to have to answer that question, and FERC's going to have to require them to provide that data, so that this way, at least the people downstream will know what the level of risk are, and hopefully we can get the federal government to hold DWR responsible for future damages.
How long is the relicensing process take if they've been undergoing that process since 2007, you said?
Yeah, well, they actually started in 2000, okay?
Wow.
So and then they were telling everybody we had to have all this information done, you know, like in 5 years, which we all did. There was a breakdown in the collaborative process. DWR decided, oh, we're not going to look at the overall impacts of the project. We're just going to focus right here just below the dam. And, you know, the we had the Federal Fishery Services, that's the National Fishery Services, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, walk out of the meetings with us because DWR was restricting the extent of which the environmental assessments were being confined. So they were restricting the prescriptive and regulatory authority of these fishery agencies. And they never resolved that problem.
Wow.
So now, you know, sometimes it can take up to 15 years. But, you know, this has been going on for too long. And so, fortunately, the door is still open. But, you know, we are trying now to get the support of people to raise the funds so we can file that motion of intervention on our own, if that's what's necessary, because I have standing. I was involved in that process. And by the way, when the breakdown in the collaborative process happened, and I appealed to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission saying, look, you know, the majority of people walked out. There was no redress, you know, for a protestant, you know, to resolve the problem unless DWR wanted to come to the table. How does that make sense?
Wow, it doesn't make sense at all. I'm looking at this summary fact sheet, and you were talking about the risk assessment and DWR's ultimate responsibility in actually informing residents of that risk. And in this question and answer page of this summary, it pretty much says that the lack of a federal emergency action plan, or at least the that it's not available for public view, constitutes negligence on DWR's part. Could you explain a little bit about that? Why isn't this emergency action plan available to the public?
Okay, are you ready for this one? I brought the matter up at one of the meetings subsequent to the 2017, you know, partial collapse of the spillway, which, as I said, their own expert said that was DWR's fault. Negligence, failure, maintenance, you know, so forth and so on. So I said, you know, I would like to have the emergency action plan made public. Because in previous floods, such as the 1997 flood, DWR was supposed to meet with the state offices of emergency services in Marysville. I might have mentioned this earlier. They didn't show up. And they were, you know, when the OES, that's the Office of Emergency Services, asked them, you know, what's going to happen? They were thinking they were going to have more than 400,000 cubic feet coming in. And they said, are you sure about that? And DWR said, you can bet on it. But they never showed up at the meeting. Now, getting back to this emergency action plan, at the meeting, the Department of Water Resources said it's a national security issue.
What? Warning the public of the potential risk of living downstream from the dam is a national security issue?
They could not provide the emergency action plan to the public. You cannot get it. I have to file a FOIA. A Freedom of Information Act. I have all this in writing. And then if I did sign it, and they did, DWR said, okay, you can give them something, parts of it, or whatever, I'd have to sign an agreement that I would not disclose that to anyone.
Wow.
So the other part of this equation comes back down to, you know, DWR has shifted the responsibility for notification, and, you know, the 2017 situation was the same thing. They gave 188,000 people less than 24 hours to evacuate.
They gave them like 20 minutes to evacuate, from what I could gather.
Well, yeah. Well, what I'm saying, you know, there were people that were moved three different times.
Yeah.
So DWR is, you know, been extremely negligent. So I mentioned to them that, you know, they were concerned that people would have too much knowledge about the infrastructure of the dam, okay? You know, in the inner workings and, you know, how the system works, okay? That's what their concern was. Well, I had already been in touch with the state archives and the state library's office, and I happen to have the five volumes on everything about how the State Water Project was constructed, all of the electrical, you know, mechanisms and how it, the internal workings, the schematics, all the engineering designs, and they're available right there in Chico. If you go to the archives, the government archives section at the Chico Library, they're there. And so I had made contact with the, you know, the state library, and they said they were, had them available if anybody wants to come and see them. So I said, that is not going to fly. That the first and foremost, people who are being put at an unacceptable level of risk, the law requires that they're supposed to know.
I would expect that. I would expect to understand that.
Well, the other part of the problem is...
How do they claim it's a national security issue?
Because they're saying if somebody had too much information about the inner, you know, workings of the reservoir, that some, you know, a possible terrorist or whatever will come over there and do something. You know, I mean, this whole thing was so absurd. For example, when they finished the spillway, they rebuilt the spillway, and not too long, 2 years ago, there were cracks already found in the spillway.
In the new one.
Now, you probably heard. So what happened was the woman, her name was Mellon. She's with the Public Information Office of the State Resources Agency, which, you know, DWR is under that agency. And she said they anticipated cracks. So the forensic experts came back and said, that's unacceptable. Cracks are not good. That's what caused the problem to begin with.
Right.
Uplifted the damn slab. And that's how all that stuff got started. So this is the kind of information they're putting out. Now, I could have been, you know, I'm not a derogatory person, but, you know, when somebody speaks like that, you know, you start wondering, you know, maybe they need to, you know, I mean, of course, suggesting, you know, go get an MRI, see if you have any cracks in your skull.
Well, I mean, yeah, of course, concrete's going to crack, but how long is that going to take? I wonder how long the cracks were actually there before 2017. How long were those cracks?
Well, we know for sure they were there for several years, and that there were problems up at the gate. I have that data. I got it. You know, I forced it out of them from the Public Records Act. But, you know, according to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, you know, it says that the outflow from that reservoir could be as high as 623,000 cubic feet a second. That is frightening.
Yeah, that's way more than the downstream infrastructure can hold back, right?
Oh, yeah. That's where the problem's going to come in. And the Arc Storm Report, anyone can get it if they go online, just USGS Arc Storm Report. They can get that report. It also shows that they estimate there'll be more than 60 levee breaks.
Wow. Huh? I mean, that doesn't even make sense to make a facility that can spill over more water than the downstream flood protection infrastructure can handle. It's actually designed to fail.
Now you hit it right on the head. A lot of people don't know. I have a confidential report that the Department of Water Resources put together. And it showed that, you know, during the 1907 and 1909 flood, the water that used to come down the Feather River, I don't know if you're familiar, about 6 miles downstream from the city of Oroville, there's the State Water Project's Thermalito After Bay.
Right, yep.
And the river, as it comes down, it makes a sharp right-angle turn. You know, it's near Hamilton Bend, or Hazelton Bush, whichever you want to call it. And most of the water would go over that, you know, the natural alluvial, you know, deposits, you know, that were there from time immemorial. The water would race all the way across, like in the 1861, 62, all the way across the Butte Basin, sort of Butte Basin, and break, and the 1907, 1909 flood, broke the levees on the west side of the Sacramento River. Could you imagine?
Wow.
So what they did is they came back and blocked off the natural overflow for the floodwaters at Oroville. So the real problem has got started when they completed the flood control levees there on the Feather River back in early 1950s. So there was no way for the water to escape. So they essentially took a problem that was affecting another area and put that problem on the backs of the people downstream from the reservoir.
It's actually a highly populated area.
The Butte County Board of Supervisors raised the question to the Corps of Engineers, why did they, the initial maximum releases from Oroville was supposed to be at 100,000. And they just arbitrarily switched it to 150 when everybody knew that 150 would cause problems like back in the 55 flood and the 64 flood. There's been 20 floods, major floods, since the 50s on that bed of the river.
20, huh? Well, I didn't realize that many.
50. Since the 1950s, there's been 20 major floods. So what we're saying is that the system, and there was in 2012, I worked for 15 years pro bono, pushing to get a master flood control comprehensive plan in effect. And in 2012, we suggested three ways to minimize or mitigate the impacts associated with these high volume of flows, which, as you mentioned, was not designed to handle these types of excessive flows. And in the last minute, they took those three suggestions out of that $17 billion plan. One was to get, a bypass, which could handle X amount of water. We could also use the wildlife area to store water. And then the other part was to provide more flood storage space at Oroville. And then the last of all, we were saying DWI has a responsibility to make sure or to ensure that the Feather River Channel can handle whatever, what the flows are, in the manual. But if you've been on the river, you'll note there's a lot of sandbars and gravel bars all through the river, okay? It was so bad that, boats were running aground. In the 2017 and the 1997 flood, the water was 20 to 30 feet high, huh? One of my clients had to get, a lift to take aluminum boats with motors on them from the top of the walnut trees.
Wow.
Now, this flood that we're talking about that USGS has identified, and they're upgrading that ARC storm report now, there'll be as much as 30 to 40 feet of water downtown under the DWR is required to come up with what they call a flood inundation a map, okay? And what they decided was to use a sunny day forecast or a fair weather forecast. That would be with a dam breach. And even looking at that data shows that they'd be under as much as 10 to 20 feet of water in downtown Oroville. We used that along with the USGS flood inundation map, which showed the dam intact. And the water would be much, much higher. And there's been some studies that go back to the 1861-62 flood, which showed all that debris was moved down as far as into the bay. And ultimately...
Wow, all the way to the bay? Got through the delta out to the bay?
Yes, wow. Yes. And they're predicting this is what will happen now. This is with the climate change, this...
Look, yeah, it could happen any year.
The probability is getting, as I said, if we had that arc storm we had back here on October 24th, we could have had a catastrophe that, the USGS is saying it would be the worst catastrophe in the history of this country.
Are you saying if it had happened in like January or February instead of October?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
And yeah, I know.
Wet conditions, and if they were, basically already in the flood storage space, yes, that's... See, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers sent DWR letters, and there was testimony. You've got to operate that project according to the flood control procedures and manual, because making decisions and holding back on water is a recipe for disaster. We have all those documents. I mean, I have... the report that I did, which was independent of the fact sheet report, the one, the Q&A one that you have, is 213 pages. It's got 300 endnotes, and it's got 2,000 pages of appendices, okay?
Well, you've been working on this for a while. Hey, Patrick, we only have a couple minutes left, so if there's anything that you could let our listeners know about how, you know, anything that the public can do about, you know, how can this get changed? You know, I guess the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission would be the regulatory body that could actually enforce some things on DWR as far as flood control and whatnot, or, you know, what can be done about all this?
Well, I think the most important thing at this point in time is, you know, getting a motion of intervention filed with FERC, okay? And you got to give the Feather River Recovery Alliance credit, you know, but they're a small group, and, you know, they're not used to dealing with government, you know, on this type of level. I would suggest that they contact the FFRA, or they can contact or send emails to us, and we can forward them information about what's going on now and give them a progress report as to what next steps we're already engaged with, the steps we're already engaged in. So I will give you my email address. Okay.
Okay.
Can I do that for you now?
Sure.
Okay, so I'm going to say it and then I'm going to spell it. It's PP, as in people, at PorgansSolutions.com. So now I'm going to spell it out. PP at PORGANSSOLUTIONS.com. We also have a website, and it's www.planetarysolutionaries.org. So that's how they can get in touch with me. And I would also suggest that they contact the Feather River Recovery Alliance there in Orville. The person heading that up is Robert Bateman.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Patrick. Now, while that was a lot of information, I hope everybody got a lot out of that. I know I certainly did, and I'm still going through some of the documents that you had sent me to prepare for this interview, actually. You know, let me know, Patrick, if there's any news on, you know, the MOI getting filed or anything like that, any updates that you might want to come back on. I'm here on the first Thursday of every month with the North State Water Report. So anytime you want to come back on and talk more about this and update folks, just let me know.
Yeah, and do you keep your programs on file where, you know, if you send me a link, I can send it to people and they can listen? Is that something that you do or not?
Yes. Yes, we do. And I can do that for you.
Send me that link and I'll send that out to the people I know. And then the last thing that we're focusing on right now is the privatization of the public's water resources. How you and I are paying these large billionaires to take our water and privatize it.
Yeah, then they sell it. They take it for free and they sell it.
That's what's going on now. And, you know, there's a lot happening in your county right now. You know, they've got the
I've had a couple shows on the Tuscan Water District, and then there's Sites Reservoir they want to start.
Yes.
They're
and
slated
then, and
to
lodging Shasta.
Yeah.
And then they've got the tunnel, you know, down the Delta, and then they've got the Pacheco project, and all that water has to come from the Feather River or the Sacramento River, okay?
Yeah.
This stuff has got to stop.
Yeah.
So we're available, and Ron, I want to thank you for your program and your listeners, and I apologize if we overwhelm them with numbers, but people need to understand what all this means.
Yeah, no, that's okay, Patrick.
Their lives are in jeopardy.
Yeah, and like I said, if you ever want to come back on again and give some more updates or talk a little bit more about something that we didn't cover, just let me know and we'll have you back on.
Yeah, sounds good. We'll get to meet someday and we'll go over some of the other details. And thanks again and very best to you now.
Thank you, Patrick.
And that was Patrick Porgans of Porgans and Associates, who has been working on monitoring the operations of the State Water Project's Oroville Dam and Reservoir Flood Control Operations since 1985. And I hope you all got a lot out of that show tonight. I know I certainly did. Up next will be Planetary Radio, and Planetary Radio is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by KIXE, PBS, Indie Lens, Pop-Up, a neighborhood series of film screenings and community-driven conversations. This event features documentaries to draw local residents, leaders, and organizations.